How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
Becker on Darren, Donick, and Chase. Looking forward to our next interview. Howard Beck, who's a senior NBA writer for the Bleacher Report and has been covering the league for a long time, and he is on the line with us. Howard, how you doing?
Good morning, guys. Doing well. How are you?
We're doing fantastic. We've talked a lot during quarantine times, like a lot of sports talk shows, about The Last Dance, which has got a lot of attention and have had great ratings on Sunday nights, and they're going into their final two episodes. But we were just talking, Howard, before we brought you on, that this week there's been some stuff written how Scottie Pippen hasn't exactly been pleased with how he's been portrayed, and I'm sure it's because of last Sunday's episode. So what do you make of that, and how do you feel through eight episodes? What's your take to this point?
We haven't heard Scottie Pippen say this, so and I don't even know where that one came from. That one kind of bubbled up out of nowhere. But the portrayal, and I'm putting that in like air quotes, portrayal, there's no narrator. There's no voice of God in this documentary. It's all people who lived this at the time who are narrating it, including Scottie Pippen himself, including Phil Jackson, including Michael Jordan, including Steve Kerr, and all these guys. And the... yes, if you want to frame something in a documentary, of course, you can do it that way. But if anybody were to try to, assert that the documentary put Scottie Pippen in a certain light, I would defend the director, Jason Hare, on this one. And I would just say that Scottie Pippen represented himself. Scottie Pippen sat there and said, I have some regrets about about refusing to go back in the game when the final play was drawn up for Tony Kukoc instead of me. So he regrets it. He feels bad about it. But in the next breath, he says, and I wouldn't do anything differently. And that's kind of confusing, but that's Scottie Pippen's own words. And everything else about that moment and Scottie's overall place on that team and how he was regarded by teammates, the full spectrum of it is there. His teammates praise him as being a phenomenal teammate and a guy they loved, and that's why they were so shocked and disappointed at that moment. But, I don't think Scottie Pippen comes off badly. I think this is a moment that happened. It happened a long time ago, but it happened. He can't get away from it. He has talked about it. He has owned up to it. And he said he has some regrets, but at the same time, he says he would do it again. So, I don't know where the complaint could be about the quote-unquote portrayal. I mean, it's a similar thing with Jerry Krause. You see the full spectrum there. The documentary makes very clear how savvy, how shrewd of a GM Jerry Krause was and how instrumental he was in creating the roster around Michael Jordan over the course of that decade. And it also shows that the Bulls had, a lot of, contempt for him. The players did, and Phil Jackson did. And they said a lot of not nice things, and they mocked him. And, it's the complete picture. And, again, people have said, it's been unfair to Jerry Krause. Well, Jerry Krause is not alive to defend himself, but others in the documentary certainly spoke to what his positive contributions were, too. So I don't understand if anybody has any issues with, in particular, either of those two portrayals, because I think we saw the full picture. That's an accurate portrayal of these guys.
There's been a lot of people featured in this documentary that have been more than willing, to do interviews and talk after these episodes. Why do you think Scottie Pippen really, unless I've missed it, we were just talking about that earlier, I haven't seen anything from Scottie Pippen. And to your point, you said that at the beginning, why do you think he's chosen really not to speak on anything of this?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I'm not in a position to speculate on that. I mean, he's got a recurring, position on ESPN's The Jump with Rachel Nichols. And I'm sure if they wanted to cover it, I mean, I don't know if they have. I mean, I'm not watching every minute of every basketball show or reading every single story. So I could have missed it too. I don't know if he has talked about it. I imagine he has probably, if I had to guess, you know, he sat for a long time for this documentary, and he probably figured that will speak for itself. And if he wants to clear anything up, he certainly has every avenue available to him. He works for ESPN.
So through your eyes, what did you see from this Bulls dynasty? What do you remember? We all lived it. I think we're all about the same age, Howard. And so what did you see from that magic around the 2 three-peats through your eyes and what they meant for the game?
I mean, in that era, in that time frame, I'm mostly just a casual fan like anybody else. I was still in California where I grew up. I didn't have a particular NBA team. I grew up in the Bay Area at a time when the Warriors were terrible. So I think, like everybody else in the country, I was a de facto Bulls fan because Michael Jordan was just so much fun, so spectacular. Scottie Pippen, I loved Pippen's game. I loved that Phil Jackson was this iconoclast who just did things differently, spoke differently, thought differently. All of that was – everything about the Bulls was just exciting and refreshing and interesting. And I started covering the NBA in 97-98, the Last Dance season, but I was covering the Lakers. I was completely immersed in that. So I didn't have any real front-row exposure to the Bulls, aside from the two times the Lakers played them that season. So my perceptions of them were almost entirely from the couch, from a fan perspective. And, yeah, I just remembered how much fun they were to watch and that they were, you know, they were so incredibly dominant. And I know that there is, you know, I'm aware that there is some backlash that some people got sick of them by the end of the 90s or by the end of the run. I don't remember it that way myself much. I remember thinking that everybody, unless you were a hardcore fan of the Sonics or the Blazers or the Lakers or the Celtics or the Pistons, that everybody pretty much became, they were like America's team. That was the team that everybody else was pulling for because everyone loved watching Michael Jordan. Everyone loved watching him perform.
We're talking to Howard Beck, and we're talking about the Last Dance. And Howard, I think you make a really, really interesting point. Retrospectively, even if you didn't root for them, and I was in the category of I never really rooted for the Bulls, but you couldn't take for granted the spotlight that they just shined on everything, right? I mean, even in a non-NBA town like Nashville, that was compelling television and content for our radio show at the time. And this was before Nashville became a major league sports market. So it was huge. And then after he retired, you realized what an impact he had, you know, what him not being there did to the league there. I heard Bob Costas say the last game of the 98 final is still the highest rated NBA final game or NBA game ever in the history of the league. So that ought to tell you something there.
Yeah, I mean, the Bulls were appointment viewing, and Michael Jordan was the biggest, most popular athlete on Earth and one of the most popular figures, period, on Earth. And, who didn't love Michael Jordan? You know, if you're a Pistons fan, you probably didn't, and if you were some other teams that got rolled by him, but you know, he was so charismatic, and he was, you know, just such a different kind of superstar. And of course, as we know, he's the first who really, you know, transcended the game in terms of the marketing side and everything else. And I don't know if there's much more to say on that, but he was universally popular.
Howard, I know you had a chance on your podcast to talk to the director of The Last Dance. And help me with his last name. Jason, how do you say his last name?
Like the hair on your head.
Okay. All right. I didn't want to butcher it there. So he's under the spotlight just like everybody involved with this for how he's put this together. He's gotten a lot of praise, but he has had his share of criticism. So you talked to him about that. So how did he handle that?
Very constructively. I mean, he understands that the spotlight that he is in as the director of this incredible project, that one, there was just the responsibility of being the one charged with this and handling all that old footage that became part of the through line of this thing, all that behind the scenes footage from 97-98, and the responsibility to, you know, explore not just Jordan, but the Bulls and how that dynasty came together. how it came, you know, how it started to, you know, to fray and then reconstructed along the way. Jordan's departure, Jordan's return. Like, there's so much that he had to tackle in this, but also going in knowing that the footage that became the springboard for this, that behind the scenes stuff that NBA Entertainment shot, it was always done under the understanding that Jordan and the NBA had to both agree on how it was going to be used. And so as a documentarian, Jason Herr goes in knowing, okay, these are my partners on this. And I think people have unfairly kind of extrapolated to say, like, oh, well, Jordan had final cut. Jordan is the one dictating all this. Jordan, I don't believe that's the case. And in my conversation with Jason Herr on my podcast, I think it came through pretty clearly that, you know, yeah, this is the understanding of the usage of this footage, but he's not running everything by Michael Jordan in terms of thumbs up, thumbs down. And he did go in saying, like, we have to tackle some of the issues that are sensitive, whether it was, you know, the death of Michael's father and the stupid conspiracy theories that surrounded that, or, you know, getting into Michael's gambling and getting into his, you know, he answers finally to the Republicans buy sneakers too line and what the context was and why he said it and what his thoughts were on being politically active or not, as he chose not to be. And, you know, I think, you know, if the people understandably said, well, you could have done more on this one. You could have gone deeper on this. You could have pressed further. You could have interviewed this guy. Yeah, but it's also a 10-hour documentary, and it had a lot of ground to cover. And there's any number of subplots that could have been, you know, an hour into themselves. But a lot of these issues, you know, you had 5-6 minutes, and then you got to get to the next thing because they're covering a lot of ground. So, you know, my explanation that I've just given you, I think, is the explanation that I got from Jason Herr on the podcast, which is, you know, that's how he treated it. He tried to hit all the important issues, but there was also a lot to cover. And I don't think he compromised at all.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to emphasize, because I've seen the him quoted in some other articles, too, along those same lines, that he's defended a little bit the Michael Jordan had, quote, the final say. And I do think that's, I guess, twisted or somewhat true to a degree, but I thought he worked with that about as well as you can, because, as most people have stated, this doesn't happen unless you're working with Michael Jordan here. And this is still unprecedented because he's never really done his own authorized biography of any kind.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, we haven't heard from Michael very often in the years since he retired, or certainly since he retired for good from the Wizards in the early 2000s. And, you know, he doesn't, you know, spend much time in the public eye. He doesn't talk much. And something like this, he's probably only going to do once. And so there were two things that we got out of this documentary that, you know, we've been waiting decades for. One is for Jordan to reflect on all of these things, on himself and those teams and the way that he conducted himself. And that stuff's all new. The interview of Jordan alone in the present day was worth doing. And on top of that, we got the behind the scenes footage that had been sitting, you know, in a crate somewhere next to the Ark of the Covenant from the Indiana Jones movie. So, you know, it's getting those things in whatever parameters were necessary, I think is worth the project. And, you know, again, I don't think there's any one area you can point to and say, like, oh, they skipped this part to out of deference to Michael or anything. No, they hit all the most important stuff.
We're talking to Howard Beck from Bleacher Report, talking NBA and The Last Dance. And I'm curious of what you thought about from a couple episodes ago. They did have footage of Kobe Bryant talking about Michael Jordan, and Kobe made the comment that they probably don't win the 5 championships without the advice that Kobe got from Michael. What were your thoughts on those comments and Kobe's praise for MJ?
You know, I covered Kobe from 97 to 2004. And, you know, when I first got on the beat, it was his second year in the league. And at that time, there was still, you know, a lot of this observation of, wow, this, you know, this kid, he plays a lot like Michael. He talks like him. He's got some of his mannerisms. And at that time, Kobe really kind of pushed back at that. He didn't want anybody to think he was trying to be Michael Jordan. He was always trying to certainly play like him. Like, it's the same position. They're about the same size. And of course, he was his idol. And so He relished the chance to learn from him, which you see that in the documentary. You get some clips of that, of how Kobe had asked him for advice along the way. And but he also wanted to carve out his own identity, of course. And what's interesting is that at the end, of Kobe's own run in the NBA, and there was an interview I did with him a few years back where he said, yeah, I stole damn near every move from Michael. Of course I did. And so by the time he's retiring, he's no longer worried about people saying, oh, you're trying to copy Jordan. But the distinction that Kobe always made, at least to me, and I think this comes through a little bit in the Last Dance too, is that, Michael was the best at what he did and at that position, and Kobe played that position. And so it's not so much that Kobe's trying to be Michael. It's just saying, if this guy does it the best, of course I want to do it the way he does it. So of course I'm going to copy all that. But as Kobe had told me a few years back too, Michael cribbed a lot of his stuff from Jerry West and Dr. J and others that came before. And so Kobe just saw it as a continuum. So it's interesting the way he would interpret the or react to the comparisons early in his career versus later in his career versus retirement. I love the fact that we got some more insight into the Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant friendship, because that was something that even those of us who had been around Kobe during his career didn't realize just how deep that went between them. And I think most of us learned that more from Michael's eulogy back in February, when Michael gave the eulogy at Kobe's memorial. That's the first time we really saw the curtain pulled back on just how close they'd become. And this documentary, The Last Dance, gives us a little bit more of that. And I told Jason Hare, the director, I really wanted even more of that. I would have watched an hour of just Michael and Kobe talking about their friendship.
Well, yeah, and that kind of leads me to my next question, because I feel like if I know everybody wanted to see this and wanted to see a Michael Jordan-esque documentary that goes a deep dive into his relationships and everything involved with his career. But I know for me, the next one would be Kobe. And obviously it would be a lot different now because he's no longer with us. But do you think that could come down the pike and maybe we could get more of a deeper dive into the Michael and Kobe relationship?
I don't know. A camera crew followed Kobe and the Lakers his final season in 2015-16. And so I don't know how the family is going to handle all that footage or who's got the final word on that and whether that will all see the light of day at some point. I don't know if there's anything more, whether it was shot for The Last Dance or for anything else or by the Lakers TV partner, whether there's anything more of Kobe talking about Michael that maybe we haven't seen yet. There's a lot I would still, that we would all, I think, still love to learn and hear. And unfortunately, we will not get this version, the Kobe version of The Last Dance, 20, 25 years from now, because Kobe is gone. And although we will get other people who there are plenty of others around who can speak to the Laker dynasty and to Kobe's place in it and all of that, losing his voice obviously is really tough. Losing him, period, is tough. I do hope, selfishly, as a reporter, as a basketball fan, as somebody who followed Kobe's career closely, that at some point down the road here that maybe we'll get to see some of the behind-the-scenes footage that was shot during his final season with the Lakers, and that maybe somebody can build something around that does give us a little bit more new insight into him and his career. It will have some limitations on it, obviously, but I do think there's still more there to tap into because that footage exists somewhere.
Howard, before we let you go, I do want to get your thoughts on what's going to happen in the coming weeks with the NBA. And, there are a lot of different reports. It changes almost every day of, what could happen to get the season resumed. If they get it resumed, do they go to the playoffs? You have Shaq and others saying that they should just scrap the season and focus on next year. So how do you see this going here in the next few weeks with a potential return of the NBA?
Yeah, I make no predictions, and I hate to even guess. Everything is changing constantly, and the league has a lot to weigh. There are money issues, huge money issues. There's just the competitive issues of just wanting to to finish out a season. And there's, of course, all these public safety issues. And it's not just about getting your players back together and playing games and all the logistics involved. It's about the impact that can have just in general, because it's going to require a lot of testing. And we still don't have enough testing in this country for average citizens. So how is, you know, the NBA or any other sports league going to commandeer thousands of tests to pull this off? What happens when somebody tests positive? Do you just keep going? What happens if it spreads? How do you handle their families? I mean, there's just so much, and I don't think we have great answers. I think the NBA has been studying it and trying to map out a plan, obviously, but they're not sharing much of that with the public. We hear leaks and drips and drabs, but I'm not convinced as we sit here today that they've got a solid plan that's safe and viable. If they do, we'll hear about it soon enough, I guess, because the clock is ticking. And, you know, eventually the window closes. Eventually you have to decide whether or not there's, whether you can pull it off at all, because eventually you're going to want to start the next season. And I think the only thing I could tell you for sure is that whenever we see the NBA playing again, it will be without fans. And I think even when next season begins, it will probably be without fans. And I think that's going to be sports in general for probably the next 12 months. I mean, according to the experts I've talked to, we should not be expecting fans to be at sporting events until at least the middle of next year.
So do you feel there'll be a champion from the 2019-2020 season crowned?
I don't know. My guess is they'll find a way to do at least that. Whatever that requires, because you don't have to finish off the regular season. You don't have to bring in all 30 teams. If you can limit it to just the playoff teams, now it's only 16 teams that you got to deal with. And you shorten up. You can make it best of three in the first round if you want. You can do anything you want to shorten it up. And if you could compact everything to, only 1 month of playoffs instead of two, and 16 teams that quickly dwindle down to eight after a best of three first round, which you can conclude in less than a week, you can manage the numbers a lot better that way. That's less testing. That's less people quarantined. That's less everything. But that's also sacrificing a lot of TV appearances, TV games, and a lot of money. And it also, may not rub them right in terms of historically. If we've always had best of seven series and we're doing best of three or best of five and suddenly it doesn't feel right, maybe the NBA doesn't have the stomach for that. I don't know. But these are all things that they've got to figure out. But, look, if I had to guess, I would guess that they will find a way to crown a champion. I don't know exactly how or when, but it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't.
Yeah. Howard, really appreciate the visit. Thank you so much. Continue to be safe, and let's talk down the road. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, fellas. Thanks for having me.
All right. That is Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report, and he also does a podcast, has been covering the league, as you just heard, for a long time. We'll come back and wrap up the first hour of Darren, Donick, and Chase next.
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.